And greetings. Thank you so much for joining us. Yep. Hope that you're doing well right here on The Natural Nurse. And Dr. Z, we're so happy to be joining you as we do right here on Progressive Radio Network. We've actually been part of the lineup here on Progressive Radio Network since the station started. And of course, it's Gary Null's network. We're so happy to be a part of it. And we love to hear from you. The best way to get in touch is to go to naturalnurse.com. And at naturalnurse.com, you can go to calendar. On the calendar, we have many of our upcoming classes, many of which now, of course, are online. And it's interesting because they were online for a long time before this, but now so many people are used to joining in on Zoom calls and all kinds of other calls that it's a lot of participation. Yesterday we had a class on thyroid and adrenals, and we had so many participants. It was excellent. A lot of people are interested in that and what herbs you can use. And also all of our classes have CE unit credits. That means if you are a professional with many different kinds of licenses, such as an RN or a nurse practitioner, an RD, who's a nutritionist, a clinical nutritionist, an ND, naturopathic physician, a licensed acupuncturist, a massage therapist, all of those professions get CE units from taking the Natural Nurse classes. So you can just go to naturalnurse.com and look on calendar. And all of those classes are also open to anyone, so you don't need any kind of license to take it. You can take it perhaps just for your own knowledge, or if you're working with a specific health issue that you need more help on the natural side. And many of our classes are also free. So go to naturalnurse.com, look at calendar, and sign up for any of the many up-and-coming classes that we have. And also, I'd like to remind you that every one of our classes, and there are over 2,000 topics, because we've been doing this for over 50 years, are also available as an individual class where you say, I want to learn about what can I do for arthritis, or I want to learn about what can I do for, you know, absolutely anything, let's say COVID or any kind of viral infection. What can you use naturally? What can be done? And we can have a whole class on that. So it's very, very open. It's both by group classes, which are listed at naturalnurse.com calendar. Also, we have all our books listed there under books. So we love to hear from you at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Today, we are so happy to have as our guest a very preeminent physician. And this is Claude Lardinois. And he's an emeritus professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, University of Nevada School of Medicine in Nevada. He's a board certified endocrinologist, and his research interests include work in nutrition, diabetes, hypertension, and all kinds of other heart issues. He has a notable interest in eradicating heart disease, which is a major cause of death in the world. And thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Claude Lardinois.
Glad to be here.
Can you tell me the correct pronunciation of your name?
It is Lardinois. You were correct.
Okay, so it sounds French.
Yes, right. It is French.
And may I call you Dr. Claude during our interview today?
Sure.
So one thing that I looked up recently, and you can do this also, listeners, I actually went to PubMed and I found, Dr. Claude, you actually have a brand new article up there specifically on fats in cardiovascular disease.
That's correct. I challenged the dogma that's been going on for 50 years that saturated fats and eating red meat are bad for you. And it's totally false. It's all based on the silly belief that fat will clog your arteries, but sugar will not. And it's the exact opposite. So I'm actually in the process of putting together maybe a paper on this subject, because Ansel Keys and George McGovern, and a lot of people don't appreciate, there was a hurricane that wiped out all the sugar cane in 1980. And at that time is when the epidemic of obesity took off. And that's when we made this silly recommendation that fat is bad for you and carbohydrates are good for you.
And in addition, added to that insult, wouldn't that be replacing things like butter with margarine and trans fats?
Correct. And, you know, being a Wisconian, and when I lived in Wisconsin, we were not allowed to buy margarine. We had to go over to Illinois because we were protecting our farmers. And you're absolutely right. Everybody thought that the partially hydrogenated vegetable oils would be better for you. And that's clearly not been the case.
In fact, it is probably one of the most damaging to the lining of the circulatory system. So true. So many things. How do we separate, as a physician with lots of letters after your name, and you are so highly qualified and have spent years investigating, how do these things become, let's say, medical law?
Well, you know, having been in the academia arena for 40 years, unfortunately, the word ego tarnishes a lot of very good scientists. You make a hypothesis, you think it's a solid hypothesis, you test the hypothesis, it seems to be working, and then later on, people are now challenging you, and some people don't like to be challenged, like Ansel Keys. He was very notable for trashing anybody that didn't like his hypothesis. And that's the problem we have. I think it's sort of like, I hate to say, it's like Congress. I mean, nobody wants to just say, let's get in the middle and let's just talk and make common sense. No, I have my views on the right, I have mine on the left, and there's no way we can get together. And that's kind of what medicine is like now, too.
Yes, I think you're right. Now, what made you decide to become a doctor as your life's work, going back in time?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. I worked as an orderly in a hospital for 4 years, 2 years in high school and 2 years in college, and I was fascinated by the doctors that worked there, and especially when I had to work the night shift and these guys would roll in at 3 o'clock in the morning. And that was the day when the doctors didn't come in scrubs. They came in suit and tie. And so I just marveled at these guys, how they could work all day long, or they'd get up in the middle of the night and take care of a patient. And it's like, oh, it's no big deal. This is just part of the way it is. And so I got fascinated in it. And that's when I decided to pursue a career in medicine.
You know, that makes sense, right? Because you were kind of in the midst of it. And I bet having, as a young person, orderly on your resume in terms of jobs you had when you were applying to medical school doesn't hurt.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever put that in my resume or my CV, but maybe I should just a flashback. It was interesting.
Yes.
I got a little letter from my sister, a little text, and it was a note from a classmate of hers. She graduated in 1971, but he was injured in a car accident, and he was in the hospital for 3 months, and I actually took care of him. And he wanted to say thank you for that time that I took care of him while he was in the hospital.
That is just a really fun thing to share. Thank you so much. Now, the real topic that you wanted to focus on today, although, you know, we may go off topic,
sure,
is insulin resistance. Now, that
Absolutely.
Is a newer term. You know, I am a PhD RN, so I've been involved in healthcare also. I got my nursing degree in 1973, so it's been a long time, although mm-hmm. I started in natural medicine in 1964. So I'm always looking to where those things come together, and really in mainstream science is where they come together. So if we're looking at something like insulin resistance, what does that term mean?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think the term insulin resistance has been around for quite a long time. There was a fellow in 1930 that described that there were two different types of diabetes. And one he noticed was a patient that was very, very sick, and that was the type 1 with DKA. But there was another group of patients that didn't seem to be as sick, but their blood sugars were the same level. So he proposed that there must be, in the first one, obviously the pancreas wasn't making insulin. and he hypothesized that there's some defect in the insulin's ability to work. Now, they didn't use the term insulin resistance at that time. I think the term insulin resistance really started by Dr. Jill Reeven at Stanford, and I had the proud honor of working with him back in the early 80s when the insulin resistant model was actually created. A lot of people like to use the term metabolic syndrome. It's interesting. I'm a virtual on diabesity this week, and they brought up and said it's kind of an old term. Well, to me, it was never a really good term because many people did not meet the criteria for metabolic syndrome, but clearly had insulin resistance. And insulin resistance, as Dr. Reeven has said, is, I'll just quote you, what he won the Banting Award in 1988. That's the highest honor that the American Diabetes Association gives. And he stated, the fact that an insulin-resistant subject may not become diabetic does not mean that they suffer no untoward consequences. Indeed, that the attempt to compensate for the insulin resistance sets in motion a series of events that play an important role in the development of both hypertension and coronary artery disease. Now, this was in 1988. Now we know insulin resistance is tied with insulin, with coronary artery disease, PCOS, kidney disease, including hyperfiltration, which most physicians don't even look for because the lab doesn't give you the opportunity to. It's also associated with cancers, and probably more importantly than most people don't know, it's a strong link with Alzheimer's disease. In fact, Alzheimer's disease is an insulin-resistant state, and it now is called type 3 diabetes.
So that is so interesting, because I think one of the things I find in conventional medicine, which I think is incorrect, but certainly there in practice, is that you as an endocrinologist and someone else who's a cardiologist versus an oncologist will have different focuses instead of actually looking at the individual where these things are interplaying and their feedback mechanisms. They're not where you just end endocrinology and go to cardiology.
Correct. And it's. I think we're going to have a new, I'm not sure what the title is going to be. I think it's going to be like endocardiology or something. And the reason for that is if you look back 100 years ago, it was chemistry and it was biology. And we knew that both of those linked very closely together. So then it became biochemistry. And I think that's the same thing that's happening here, but now with these new drugs to protect the heart, the SGLT2s and even the GLP-1s, that we now know there's a strong link now between cardiologists and endocrinologists because the drugs we're giving reduces heart failure and coronary artery disease. So now we're educating the cardiologists on that they should be treating patients with diabetes medicine, which they have never been comfortable doing before. So I think we're going to see emerging, and I know there's a title that somebody's floating around right now that they're trying to come up with, but I can't quite remember what the name was.
But it really more closely represents what's going on in the body. That's the point. Like perhaps
right.
In medicine, all these clear lines and individualization and naming, you know, both the healthcare professionals, which you certainly have a focus on, but in the patient, there's no division.
Right. No, that's true. I mean, I remember in medical school, I remember we would do biochemistry, then we would do anatomy, then we would do physiology. And I kind of comment, it's like a house. I have all these rooms in the house, and they all have different titles, but somehow we have to merge all the rooms in the house together so that we're dealing with one common entity.
And it's so true, because you, as an endocrinologist, having a lot of your scientific focus sort of dribbling over into cardiology, which is
right.
Where it goes in someone's body.
Yeah, I've actually been accused of being a cardiologist disguised as an endocrinologist because
a cardiologist wannabe, but really your knowledge is just profound.
Yeah, well, because I've never been real Nazi on the A1C because I worked at the VA and we actually helped set up the VA guidelines for diabetes back in 1988. And if everybody goes, nobody wants to look at those guidelines, because we proposed back then that older patients, especially ones with complications, the A1C should never be, probably shouldn't be any lower than 8. And they just freaked out on us. And I said, well, you know, if you get it down to 7, you're going to cause hypoglycemia, and that's going to harm them. Oh, no, hypoglycemia doesn't hurt anybody. Well, we now know that.
Wait. Look, you and I know what you're talking about, Dr. Claude. Let's remind our listeners, since you brought up A1C, and it's becoming a popular test, and people are told to keep it something like 5.7 or lower, and you're talking about 8.
Good point. So the A1C is a measurement of how your glucose has been over the last 3 months. And the ADA, for many, many, many years, have said that everybody should be less than 7 if you have diabetes, and preferably 6 or 5.5 if you can do that. And so there's been this constant drive in every commercial you watch on TV. Oh, under 7. Well, I would like to have everybody under 7, but I also have to look at the two important factors, the age of the patient. And we found at the VA, if they were over 75 and we tried to get them down to 7, we caused a lot of harm. So we said,
Tell us why.
It's not worth it. And then the other thing we looked at, we said, does this patient have any complications? And what we mean by complications was, did they have any eye disease, kidney disease, or neurological diseases? And if they did, we knew from sophisticated testing that we did at Stanford in the 80s that these people could not recognize hypoglycemia. And so we said, well, if somebody's got complications, we know that they're at risk for more hypoglycemia, so we better be careful in how tight we get the glucose control. Now, it is important to point out, we have a lot of new drugs now that don't cause hypoglycemia. So if you have a patient that's not taking insulin or not taking sulfonylureas like glibride or glipizide or that, then you probably can go down because these drugs won't cause hypoglycemia. But if you've got them on one of those drugs, be careful. And even when you look at the studies, in the patients that were taking those drugs, they had more hypoglycemia.
Well, of course, one of the things to do, perhaps, is not jump on that drug bandwagon so quickly. I'll give you examples. Many of my really advanced geriatric patients, people in their 90s, many of them, actually have been choosing to have no pharmaceuticals at all. So I'll talk about my mother and my father, for instance, since I'm allowed to speak about them. Whenever we go to the doctor, they'll come out and say, what drugs are you on? And they say none. And then they send the nurse over to talk to me, saying, well, you know, your parents are a little older. Maybe they're confused. They're not confused at all. I said, no, they are on no pharmaceuticals. And they're amazed. And yet every one of their blood parameters is perfect.
And
they are on a plethora of both selected foods, selected herbal therapeutics, botanicals that I choose, as well as nutritional supplements for anything that might be missing. We do quite a bit of testing, looking at things like mineral levels and vitamin levels. So it's a completely different management system.
Yeah, you actually remind me of another. The joke used to be that for every decade of life, you're on one medication. So if your parents are 90, they both should be on 9 medications.
And unfortunately, definitely 5 or more is the norm of their age group.
Yep. I'd like to get into a little bit of this insulin resistance again, because I think the important thing that I try to stress to people is, do you know if you have insulin resistance or not? It's important that everybody knows that they have insulin resistance. And in a moment I'll tell you how to diagnose insulin resistance. But one of the misconceptions, a huge misconception, is that you have to have obesity to have insulin resistance. That if you don't have obesity, you can't have insulin resistance. Well, the first paper that Dr. Reaver and I published in 1983, we were struck by the fact that we had patients in that study that had BMIs of 40, clearly morbidly obese. They had no insulin resistance. We were just amazed. Then we looked at patients with BMIs of 25 and 26, which we would say, oh, they're really okay. And they had profound insulin resistance. The problem is, people equate insulin resistance and obesity together. they're totally different. There are more people that are not obese that have insulin resistance than people that are obese that have insulin resistance. And so if you say, okay, she's not overweight, she can't have insulin resistance, you're going to miss over 60 million people in America who have insulin resistance, and you're not looking for it because you're assuming they can't have insulin resistance because they're not obese. And the flip side of that is there are patients that, like I said, this BMI of 40, okay, profoundly obese, but this person had no insulin resistance, no hypertension, no diabetes, no kidney disease, no eye disease. And so the take-home message is that don't assume because you're obese you have insulin resistance, and don't assume that if you're not obese you don't have insulin resistance. And this is a very important thing in the COVID-19 era. We're hearing this thing about obesity being the driving force. No, it's not obesity. It's insulin resistance that's the driving force. And I'll guarantee
that is profound, doctor. So first of all, let's define what is insulin resistance for our listeners.
Well, what insulin resistance just simply means is that the target tissue, the receptors, say in the muscle or the fat or in the liver, are not responding to the insulin that's released from the pancreas. And then what happens is the glucose goes up a little bit. The pancreas says, "Woo, something's wrong here. It should be 80. It's now 95. So it puts out more insulin. And then all of a sudden, the blood sugar comes down, but it comes down if the person has a higher level of insulin in their circulation. So that's where people fall into the trap. They look at their blood sugar, their fasting blood sugar, and says, "Hey, it's normal." Well, it could be normal, but you could be very insulin resistant because your pancreas is doing its best to get the body to incorporate that glucose. So, and the most important thing in medicine is that we tend to do a lot of diagnostic by fasting. We look at the fasting glucose. We look at the A1C, which is typically fasting. What we really need to do is challenge the body. What I mean by that is, in order to diagnose insulin resistance, you have to do a glucose tolerance test. And what
okay,
I mean by
so,
that is...
So wait, let's talk about that. So in other words, you gave us some great information. You just can't look at your fasting blood sugar that you might have on any normal blood test and go, "It's fine and your A1C is not high." That doesn't necessarily mean you do not have insulin resistance. So you're suggesting that most people go through additional testing to understand what their insulin resistance is.
Because the other thing is that there's really no rationale at all for fasting anymore. We used to tell patients don't eat, or drink for 14 hours, and that's just had serious consequences on people, especially people with elderly patients. So we now say you can just go in and you don't have to be fasting. Well, I, for one time, just for fun, I went in and said I was fasting, but I actually had breakfast. So my blood sugar was 111, and oh my God, the lab freaked out and said, "Oh, you got diabetes or insulin resistance, or you're in trouble, Dr. Lardinois." And I said, "No, I'm not. I had breakfast," and I said, "I've already been tested for insulin resistance, and I don't have insulin resistance." So to make the diagnosis of insulin resistance, you have to do a challenge. You have to give the person glucose. And we typically have 75 grams of glucose. And then what's important is you need to measure the glucose fasting. Then you measure it at 1 hour and 2 hours. You don't need to do the whole 3-hour glucose tolerance test like they do like with pregnancies and things like that. You just give 75 grams. You check the baseline, the 1 hour, and the 2 hour. If the 1 hour is over 125, you have insulin resistance. If the value at 2 hours is over 120, you have insulin resistance. You don't have to have both. You just have to have one. And if you're fasting, if your 1 hour is over 125 and your 2 hours over 120, you have insulin resistance. And that means, like I said, that that sets off untoward consequences that you're not going to see unless you identify you have insulin resistance. And the best tip-off is for this is, do you have hypertension? Do you have cholesterol problems, triglyceride problems? If your triglycerides are over 150, I can almost assure you you have insulin resistance. So if your triglycerides are over 150, maybe you don't need to do the glucose tolerance test because you're already insulin resistant. But the important thing is for you to know, do I have insulin resistance? And if you do, you need to get some very, you know, in-depth evaluations, and you need to look more into like advanced lipid testing. Make sure there's things like called particle numbers that you can have a normal LDL cholesterol, but you may not have a normal LDL particle number.
And so what are that you means, talking about something like the ApoA and ApoB, which we do in functional medicine?
Yeah, I think the best marker, in my opinion, for knowing if your lipids are where you want them to be is your ApoB. So as I say, B is for the bad cholesterol. ApoA is A for the awesome cholesterol, HDL. The problem is there's now dysfunctional HDL people that have HDLs of 100, but it doesn't work. So they have heart disease. So HDL has been a little bit disappointing in that we thought it was sort of the protector. And it may not be the protector, but the main thing is, like you said, ApoB. And for people that have heart disease, I think the ApoB should be less than 60, 6-0. Most labs say 80 to 100 is perfectly normal. And then they can't understand why people still have events.
So this is some very specific information that maybe is new, I would say is new to most people. So something like triglycerides, that is done pretty much for everyone all the time if they were to look back at their last blood work, which I always recommend everyone have copies of their blood work.
Absolutely.
Since I'm old, I print it out and put them in a manila folder, but for you young people, you can save it electronically. So just looking at triglycerides, which pretty much everyone will have on their last blood test, could be a clue. And you're saying over 150, that's not that high a number.
Well, you if you really want to know something, after this, there was this landmark study with Valsipa. This is an omega-3 fatty acid. It's a pure omega-3. And they gave 2 grams twice a day to patients who were on statins and had heart disease, and they saw dramatic improvements in their events. And my hypothesis was that it was because of the triglycerides. Well, it turned out the triglycerides didn't even play a role or a minor role, and it just blew me away. And so a lot of people are now saying, where did the 150 come from? You know, these are just kind of like you test 10,000 people and you say, oh, you know, most of them are under 150, so that must be normal. There's a lot of us now that believe that the triglycerides probably are normal, is closer to 100 or 125.
So if someone has a high triglyceride, let's say 220 or 225, mm-hmm. what would that indicate to you?
Well, first of all, I would say that person's probably insulin resistant, and then I would worry about all the defects of insulin resistance. Do these people have hypertension? Do they have a high LDL cholesterol as well as the high triglycerides? Do they have any albumin in their urine? You know, albumin in the urine is a marker of kidney disease and a marker of heart disease. And then other things I would look at, I'd say, well, what's their blood sugar? And do they have diabetes? And those people, it'd probably be a good idea to do a glucose tolerance test to confirm or not that they have diabetes. There was this recent paper that first of all, I'll say the reason we don't do glucose tolerance tests is because they're time consuming and people are too busy. They don't have time to wait 2 hours in the laboratory. So everybody's tried to make it simple, and we've made it simple by doing fasting. But what we've done is we've taken away the challenge, which is the most important thing. And in this study, there were 8,000 patients that had a heart attack. These people had a heart attack. They went back and looked at those 8,000 patients and said, how many of them had diabetes, how many of them had prediabetes, and how many had no diabetes? And they found out that about 15% in their CD codes had diabetes, and about 25% had that they had prediabetes. So they said, wow, that's a lot of people there's still a lot of normal people running around there. They did glucose tolerance tests on these patients, all 8,000 patients, a mammoth study, and they found that they didn't have 15% that had diabetes. It was about 30%, and the 25% that had prediabetes, it was more like 60%. So what they showed was that until you do the challenge, you don't know that that person's going to respond or not. And you know as well as I do, if a patient doesn't eat for 24 hours, they're going to come in and their blood sugar is going to look perfect. And you're saying, wow, you're doing great. But then you check their A1C and it's 11, and that's just because they starved themselves for the last 24 hours before they saw you.
So this is something that it sounds like what you're saying, Dr. Claude, is that you suggest that a glucose challenge test is done more routinely to try to confirm insulin resistance.
To me, it should be the standard of care, because insulin resistance is the driver of cardiovascular disease. So that would be like saying, well, okay, well, I'm not going to check your blood pressure because I don't think that's important. Well, we check blood pressure, and when we see a bad number, most people do react. Well, this is what we've got to do with insulin resistance. We need to say that I need to know if I have insulin resistance or not. You know, another little sidebar that I think is also important is that you have to ask the question, do I have heart disease? Okay? And that's a very important question. And how do we define whether you have heart disease or not? Well, we do like Framingham. We check your blood pressure, your weight, your age. You know, there's other factors that they look at as well. And then they give a percentage score. And they say your score is like 6%. Just for people to know, 6% is good. You have a low risk. If you're up in the 15 to 20% range, then the risk is much higher. So then you do this Framingham thing. And I'll give you an example. My Framingham score when I was, I'm 71 now, my Framingham score was 6% when I was 66 years old. And I helped set up this cardiovascular risk reduction clinic at the hospital here. But it begged the question, but do I know if I have heart disease or not? Framingham says I have a very low risk. And I tested myself for insulin resistance. I wasn't insulin resistant. My blood pressure even today is like 116 over 74. I have no albumin in my urine. My LDL cholesterol is normal. My ApoB is 59, because that's what I use, not the LDL. And so, I mean, that was a little higher before. But then I begged the question, do I have heart disease or not? I just don't know. So I decided to get a coronary calcium score. I want to know once and for all, do I have heart disease or not? And I went in that score, and I was totally confident it was going to come back zero, and it came back over 200. And it just, you know, kind of shook me in a sense. I said, well, why would I have one that high? Well, then you start looking into other genetic markers, and one of the things is I have mutations for the homocysteine gene. That's homocysteine is part of methionine and a valuable nutrient that we need in the body. And my homocysteine was high. So I genetically tested, and I have two of the mutations. And what I just discovered, I should have known this a long time ago when I knew it, is that 30% of the population has mutations for the homocysteine gene. So another thing I'm advocating to all my colleagues, measure a homocysteine in your patients. And if it's elevated, do genetic testing. And actually where this has come out, believe it or not, is from the My23, that people are doing testing and they're finding that there's a lot of people that have homocysteine mutations. Well, 30% have one, there's two mutations, and 30% have one or the other, or both. And I have both. So now I'm looking at trying to get my homocysteine down, because we know, regardless of what the, quote, experts say, people who have higher homocysteine levels, like greater than 15, die prematurely.
And they regularly, because I worked with Dr. Serafina Corsello as her head nurse for 23 years, and Dr. Corsello very much believed in doing many of these tests that you're now mentioning. It was before we actually had the genetic markers, but we did homocysteine levels pretty much on every patient. But one of the challenges was insurance did not recognize it and wouldn't pay for that test.
Yeah, this is the challenge of medicine today. We have, I don't want to say the word bimbo, it's probably not appropriate, but we have people who make medical decisions that have no medical background whatsoever. And it's interesting, this diabetes thing they've been talking, one of the things they're talking about is longevity, and they're looking at things that can not so much let people live longer, but have a better quality of life if they live longer. And so they're making these proposals to Congress and that. But this one guy said very candidly, boy, I blew it right from the beginning. I went in and said, hey, you know, we want to do a study where we think that if we do this cocktail, and there are different cocktails, so I'm not going to get into them, but if we do this cocktail, we could actually improve the quality of life and extend life by 10 years. And you know what the congressman said? Oh, my God, that'd be more Medicare or Medicaid, more Medicare and Social Security that we'd have to pay out. So that's not going to work. So
how much is based on that?
It's not. But the thing is,
I would rather have
older, healthy people than younger, sick people. You know, what we're creating is these people in their 50s and 60s now that are terribly sick, and they don't want to take care of them, which is just devastating.
That's true. Now, what you're talking about, oh, you know what? We should really take a break here for just a minute. You can take a few sips of water or whatever you think the best drink is. Maybe you'll share with us what a good diet is about. And you talked about not eliminating meat and not using vegetable oil and things like that, but we'll talk about that more when we get back. And we're going to take a little break right here. I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. You can always find us at naturalnurse.com. And our guest today is preeminent physician Dr. Claude Ladenois, and he is Professor Emeritus Endocrinology Division at the University of Nevada School of Medicine. But his knowledge goes so much beyond that and into actually what I would consider an integrated view of what's going on with our individuals. So we will be back shortly right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. Thank you so much for joining us today right here on Progressive Radio Network. And our guest today is Dr. Claude Ladenois, and he is the Professor Emeritus of Endocrinology Division at the University of Nevada School of Medicine, and also a board-certified endocrinologist. But his research interests go way beyond endocrinology into the integration of such things as nutrition, diabetes, hypertension, and high blood pressure, all kinds of cardiovascular things. So I want to thank you so much for all your research and all your work for all these decades, Dr. Claude. And thank you for being our guest today here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Now, you're giving us some phenomenal information. Is this all written somewhere where a person can take this list of different kinds of testing that you're talking about, some of which they are already done, such as triglycerides, so someone could actually use this and ask their physician to order this panel?
Absolutely. And, you know, you have my email. You can ask any of your listeners if they want to send me an email. I've actually published papers on this saying that it's time for a paradigm shift and advocating that we do more genetic testing, more inflammatory marker testing, and other, you know, non-invasive testing looking for disease. And, you know, one of the things one of the genes that I think is incredibly important, again, right now, most insurance companies aren't covering this. They're starting to. But if you go to like Quest or Boston Heart or Cleveland Clinic, and there's another one in Texas now. They used to be in Virginia. They will do this genetic testing for you. And, you know, at one time they weren't charging you any additional. They would just bill the insurance company, and then what the insurance company collected, they accepted. Now they do, I think, charge a nominal fee, but we're talking maybe $100, $150. And, you know, to me, that's like a coronary calcium score is $99. If I hadn't done that test, I wouldn't have known I had disease. And one of the genetic markers I think is incredibly important is called ApoE. Now, how many of you have heard of ApoE?
Not me. So teach me, please.
You haven't taught, you don't know anything about ApoE. Okay.
Well, we know A and B, and I have not investigated ApoE.
Well, I think when you're as a nutritionist, I think you will be blown away by how important it is to know what your ApoE isoform is. Now, we each have two isoforms of ApoE. We either have a 2, a 3, or a 4. And we get one copy from our parents. So our parents could be a 3-4, and maybe a 3-3. 3-3 is the most common. 70% of the population has, about 67 to 70% have 3-3, ApoE 3-3. But it's very important about ApoE2, but more importantly, ApoE4. Because ApoE4 is strongly linked to Alzheimer's disease. And if you have an ApoE4, which one in four people in the United States have at least one copy of 4, there is like a 4 or 5-fold risk of Alzheimer's disease. If you are not blessed and have both ApoE4-4, your risk of Alzheimer's is like 13 times greater. Now, insurance companies sometimes won't do this test because they're worried that, you know, if you know you're going to have Alzheimer's disease, you may freak out and, you know, commit suicide or do something stupid like that. In fact, just to laugh, when I got my first ApoE done, it was sent to a neurology department in Virginia. And when I called for the results, they would not give me the results. And I said, well, why not? I can't. You have to talk to your doctor. Well, I got the report back, and it said that your patient, Claude Lardinois, does not have the ApoE4 gene. I'm a 2-3. And it says, therefore, his dementia must be due to something else. And they assumed that I was demented and that my doctor was ordering the ApoE4 to confirm it. So it was a big laugh with my cardiologist about that. But so that's one important thing. But here's the other important thing. Your nutritional recommendations play heavily on your ApoE isoform. In other words, if you're a 2-3 like me, I can eat a normal meal. I mean, I can eat normal carbohydrates, protein, fats. I don't have to have any, like, more carbohydrates, less fat, etc. If you're an ApoE4, the most effective treatment is a low-fat diet. Statins don't work very well in ApoE4s because there's not a lot of the enzyme activity in ApoE4s. And this, you know, brings flashbacks when I say to my patients, I took my statin, Dr. Lardinois, but your cholesterol didn't go down. You might have taken it. Well, maybe he's a 4. The other thing about a 4 that's important is that alcohol makes lipids worse if you're an ApoE4. It makes them worse. And the old adage that, oh, a modest couple glasses of wine a day or a couple beers can't be harmful for you. Well, it could be harmful for you if you're a 4. And I'll give you a good example. My financial advisor had a heart attack 15 years ago, and he's on a statin, and he's being treated. His triglycerides are like 225, and he said, I just can't get them down. And I said, well, you know, maybe we should test your ApoE. And I explained to him what that meant. So we did it. He was a 3-4. So I had to candidly tell him that, hey, you know that glass of wine or two that you like every single day? If you're a 4, you can only have it once a week. And he said, are you serious? I said, yes, but I can assure you if you do that, your lipids will get better. And his triglycerides went from 225 down to 135. And what he did was
This is really groundbreaking information, because for me to sit here taking so many notes, I'm learning so much from you, but it sounds like there needs to be sort of a clear sheet, maybe you have that, of the kind of testing someone might do. Because truthfully, one thing that has recently changed is that anyone, in anywhere in the United States. It was in Florida many years ago, and I'm a Floridian, but now it's elsewhere as well. They can do, like you mentioned, try to put it through the insurance, but if your doctor won't order it, you can actually go into any lab now and get any test you want. And sometimes, even if it's an expensive test, when it's not coming through insurance, they have a different payment option that's lower.
Absolutely. Like the coronary calcium score. If you go in and you give your insurance card, okay, the radiologist will try to charge $2,000 to the insurance company for the test. But if you pay cash, it's $99. And I tell patients, exactly, don't go in there and give them your insurance card. Just give them the $99. And you're exactly right that a lot of these companies with now, particularly with, the technology is just, you know, exploded, that it's very easy to do these tests at a fraction of the cost it did before. I think there's even some companies now, you can have your entire genetic genome done if you want for $1,000. You know every one of your genes for $1,000.
But of course, these commercial companies like 23andMe, they're not doing some of these tests, correct? But they're very inexpensive.
Yeah, no, they're doing some of them. They're doing what I haven't really studied them recently. I mean, what got me kind of twerked was that when I was looking up this stuff on homocysteine, because I found that there was another potential drug, because I can't get my homocysteine down, and I just learned that there's a special B12 cobalamin that's supposed to work in people who have genetic mutations. And when I was looking at that, I said, well, why is all this interest in homocysteine? And it was because of 23andMe. Now, 23andMe will do your ApoE, and all they'll tell you is if you're a 4 or not. They won't tell you if you're a 3-4 or a 4-4. I'm told that they'll just tell you, you have the ApoE4 gene. And they just
and that's in the normal, in the normal one that they do, so people can at least get a start at looking at it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I have never done my 23, but I would think that if you called them and said, "Well, okay, you said I have the E4 gene, do I have one or two copies?" I would think that they should. Now, maybe they're not capable of doing that. Maybe there's a simple assay that just looks for the specific amino acid. All three of these ApoEs, all three of them are different by only one amino acid. One amino acid. One. And it's amazing how the 2, 3, and 4 are so different biologically. One amino acid, it just blows my mind. Mother Nature.
Well, that is, you know, this is all, I'm sure, very new information for many people. So one question we might be getting is, do you have a list of these tests that you're recommending? It sounds like with your depth knowledge and integrated understanding of not only endocrinology, but cardiology and insulin resistance, that really perhaps there's a way that you can introduce these concepts so that blood work moves forward to something that actually can much more closely reflect and help people in advance.
Yes, let me real quick. I actually do some consulting work for a company called SEEK, S-E-A-K, and I can, and so I put in here some of the papers that I have published, and one of them is atherosclerosis. Know your risk. Is it time for a paradigm shift? And I'm just going to click this one on real quick, and let me just see what I have in this particular paper. This might not be the specific one.
Well, I think it is time for a paradigm shift after the information that, of course, everything you're sharing is evidence-based.
Right. Yeah, it's just taking a little time to download. Here we go. Because I'm showing in this paper, I show you the ApoE genotypes, and I show you the treatments that are available. Then we get into other genetic testing that people should do, and some of this is debatable, but, you know, when you talk to some of these genetic testings, one test I do recommend is people should measure their LP little a. I'm sure you're familiar with LP little a.
Yes, I am.
Okay, everybody should have that test
LPOA,
done.
Yes.
Because if that's elevated, then you should be genetically tested to make sure that you have, because if you have one of the LPA genes, then you're at increased risk of heart disease. The reason you have to do the genetic testing is that, like the African Americans, they have a different structure to their LPA, and so they have what we call more kringles. So when the assay is measured, it tells them they have a high level. Well, they don't really have a high level. It's just a genetic polymorphism. Signature. And so you'd have to do the gene for that. But then you get into inflammatory markers. I think people should know, people always talk about hsCRP, but there's things like myeloperoxidase, homocysteine, as I said. So there's a lot of other.
Right, and you also, of course, talked about something that really has been used, which is the glucose tolerance test, but not everybody gets that.
Well, they don't do it anymore because they say it's too cumbersome. Well, you know, how cumbersome is it for 2 hours to know if you got insulin resistance or not? You know, this is where our society is so dysfunctional.
But not only that, what you have shared, and we're getting to the end of our time together, Dr. Claude, what you have shared so brilliantly is that really there should be a revamping, and as you say in the name of your paper, a paradigm shift to a completely different testing protocol, because you don't just say, okay, if this is high, you're going to get this. You're also recommending very specific dietary modifications that are not even costly if people knew what to do. And it's individualized rather than everyone following the same path.
Yeah, no. And that's the problem with medicine. We want it to one size fits all. And I remember my professor of medicine at George Washington, where I went to medical school, we were talking about stuff. And he said, well, Claude, just remember, we do statistics, and statistics is N minus one. And I said, that's true. So if you only have one patient in the study, 1 minus 1 is 0, you have no statistics. But you try to take 10,000 people and say, well, 90% fit into this package. Well, 90% might, but that's 10% that don't.
It's just, you know, it's quite amazing. Just quite amazing that you've done all this work and that actually it could make things much easier if everyone knew that they just get these tests and perhaps motivational to change certain dietary habits, which can actually reduce the risk perhaps of getting Alzheimer's, heart disease, and some really deadly situations in the future.
Yeah, especially Alzheimer's, because, you know, people have worked so hard to find treatments for Alzheimer's, and it's failed. And I listened to a lecture a couple of years ago, and a guy actually showed that the reason why APOE4s get Alzheimer's is they don't take up DHA, which is the other component of EPA, because 97% of your brain is DHA. Most people don't know that. That's a very powerful fat in your brain, because it needs all those circuits, because there's a lot of double bonds in there, so there's a lot of transmission. But he's shown that the DHA doesn't take up very well in the brain of people that have the APOE4. And he hypothesized that over time that depletes the network, and then you get Alzheimer's. So he was actually proposing that, you know, since we don't have any, let's not try to nip it at the end where we know that they got the tangles and all that, and we block the tangles. He proposed, let's get people to eat fish 3 times a week if you're an APOE4, because it certainly can't hurt you. And if you get enough of the DHA into your brain, maybe that would protect you from Alzheimer's. And I would love to see a study where there's APOE4 patients and one group gets, you know, a diet fortified in DHA. However you do it, I think nutrition would be better than supplements, and then one without, and see what happens over time. And I think the guy's right. I think that it's been shown longitudinally. Again, this is a problem with studies. It's been shown that if the people who consume more omega-3 fatty acids in their diet have less Alzheimer's disease. Now, that doesn't
mean causality. Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest. What a plethora of information. I have to go back and speak to you again about some of these things. And the information was absolutely groundbreaking for me. And if it was for me, I'm sure it also was for many of our listeners. So thank you so much, Dr. Claude Lanois, for being our guest today here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Now, I have to just give you one correction, though.
Yes.
It's Nevada.
Okay. What did I say? University of Nevada. Oh, okay.
But that's what the East Coast says. So we just have to keep
that. I'm from New York and Florida, but that was
I know. I understand. I understand. Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for joining us again, once again, here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We love to hear from you. Get in touch at naturalnurse.com. And until next time, we hope that you stay healthy.